Chapter 29. But as yet Barnett had seen no more than the mildest beginnings of modern warfare. So far he had taken part only in a little shooting. The bayonet attack by which the advanced line was broken was made at a place called Croix Rouge, more than 20 miles away, and that night under cover of the darkness the rifle pits were abandoned, and he got his company away without further loss. His regiment fell back unpressed behind the fortified lines between Namur and Sedan, entrained at a station called Medet, and was sent northward by Antwerp and Rotterdam to Haarlem. Hence they marched into North Holland. It was only after the march into Holland that he began to realize the monstrous and catastrophic nature of the struggle in which he was playing his undistinguished part. He describes very pleasantly the journey through the hills and open land of Brabant, the repeated crossing of arms of the Rhine, and the change from the undulating scenery of Belgium to the flat, rich meadows, the sunlit dike roads, and the countless windmills of the Dutch levels. In those days there was unbroken land from Alkmaar and Leiden to the Dollard. Three great provinces, South Holland, North Holland, and Zuiderzeeland, reclaimed at various times between the early 10th century and 1945, and all many feet below the level of the waves outside the dikes, spread out their lush polders to the northern sun, and sustained a dense industrious population. An intricate web of laws and custom and tradition ensured a perpetual vigilance, and a perpetual defense against the beleaguering sea. For more than 250 miles from Walcheren to Friesland, stretched a line of embankments and pumping stations that was the admiration of the world. If some curious god had chosen to watch the course of events in those northern provinces, while that flanking march of the British was in progress, he would have found a convenient and appropriate seat for his observation upon one of the great cumulus clouds that were drifting slowly across the blue sky during all these eventful days before the great catastrophe. For that was the quality of the weather, hot and clear, with something of a breeze, and underfoot dry and a little inclined to be moldy. This watching god would have looked down upon broad stretches of sunlit green, sunlit save for the creeping patches of shadow cast by the clouds, upon sky-reflecting mirrors, fringed and divided up by masses of willow, and large areas of silvery weeds, upon white roads lying bare to the sun, and upon a tracery of blue canals. The pastures were alive with cattle, the roads had a busy traffic of beasts and bicycles and gaily colored peasants' automobiles. The hues of the innumerable motor barges in the canal vied with the eventfulness of the roadways. And everywhere in solitary steadings, amidst ricks and barns, in groups by the wayside, in straggling villages, each with its fine old church, or in compact towns laced with canals and abounding in bridges and clipped trees, were human habitations. The people of this countryside were not belligerents. The interests and sympathies alike of Holland had been so divided, that to the end she remained undecided and passive in the struggle of the world powers. And everywhere along the roads taken by the marching armies clustered groups and crowds of impartially observant spectators, women, and children in peculiar white caps and old-fashioned sabots, and elderly, clean-shaven men quietly thoughtful over their long pipes. They had no fear of their invaders. The days when soldiering meant bands of licentious looters had long since passed away. That watcher among the clouds would have seen a great distribution of khaki uniformed men and khaki painted material over the whole of the sunken area of Holland. He would have marked the long trains, packed with men or piled with great guns and war material, creeping slowly, alert for train wreckers, along the north-going lines. He would have seen the Scheldt and Rhine choked with shipping, and pouring out still more men and still more material. He would have noticed halts and provisionings and detrainments, and the long, bustling caterpillars of cavalry and infantry, the maggot-like wagons, the huge beetles of great guns, crawling under the poplars along the dikes and roads northward, along ways lined by the neutral, unmolested, ambiguously observant Dutch. All the barges and shipping upon the canals had been requisitioned for transport. In that clear, bright, warm weather, it would all have looked from above like some extravagant festival of animated toys. As the sun sank westward, the spectacle must have become a little indistinct, because of a golden haze. Everything must have become warmer and more glowing, and because of the lengthening of the shadows more manifestly in relief. The shadows of the tall churches grew longer and longer, until they touched the horizon and mingled in the universal shadow, and then, slow and soft, unwrapping the world in fold after fold of deepening blue, came the night at first obscurely simple, and then with faint points here and there, and then jeweled in darkling splendor with 100,000 lights. Out of that mingling of darkness and ambiguous glares the noise of an unceasing activity would have arisen, the louder and plainer now, because there was no longer any distraction of sight. It may be that watcher drifting in the Pellucid Gulf beneath the stars, watched all through the night. It may be that he dozed. But if he gave way to so natural a proclivity, assuredly on the fourth night of the great flank march he was aroused, for that was the night of the battle in the air that decided the fate of Holland. The aeroplanes were fighting at last, and suddenly about him, above and below, with cries and uproar rushing out of the four quarters of heaven, striking, plunging, oversetting, soaring to the zenith and dropping to the ground, they came to assail or defend the myriads below. Secretly the central European power had gathered his flying machines together, and now he threw them as a giant might fling a handful of 10,000 knives over the low country. And amidst that swarming flight were five that drove headlong for the sea walls of Holland, carrying atomic bombs. From north and west and south, the Allied aeroplanes rose in response, and swept down upon this sudden attack. So it was that war in the air began. Men rode upon the whirlwind, that night and slew, and fell like archangels. The sky rained heroes upon the astonished earth. Surely the last fights of mankind were the best. What was the heavy pounding of your Homeric swordsmen, what was the creaking charge of chariots, beside this swift rush, this crash, this giddy triumph, this headlong swoop to death? And then athwart this whirling rush of aerial duels that swooped and locked and dropped in the void between the lamplights and the stars, came a great wind and a crash louder than thunder, and first one, and then a score of lengthening fiery serpents plunged hungrily down upon the Dutchman's dikes, and struck between land and sea, and flared up again in enormous columns of glare and crimson smoke and steam. And out of the darkness leapt the little land, with its spires and trees, aghast with terror, still and distinct, and the sea, tumbled with anger, red foaming like a sea of blood. Over the populous country below went a strange multitudinous crying, and a flurry of alarm bells. The surviving aeroplanes turned about, and fled out of the sky, like things that suddenly know themselves to be wicked. Through a dozen thunderously flaming gaps that no water might quench, the waves came roaring in upon the land. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.